Good afternoon. My name is Angela, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I'd like to welcome everyone to the Pharmaceutical Waste Management conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. Thank you. Ms. Levitt, you may begin your conference call.
Thank you for joining Premier today for our Trends in Pharmaceutical Waste Management webcast. The web portion of this meeting is available at https://intercall.webex.com/intercall. The meeting number is 592-507-171. The session password is WASTE, W-A-S-T-E. If you are having any issues joining the web portion of today's discussion, please refer to the slides sent to you last evening. Today's session, both the audio and visual portions, will be made available within the next few days to our attendees. Today we will be discussing updates on the increased focus on pharmaceutical waste at the EPA and how it may impact your facility. At the end of today's presentation, as was described before, we will have a question and answer session from our featured speaker, Charlotte Smith. Ms. Smith is the president of Pharmacology Associates, which she founded in 2000 to assist the healthcare industry in reducing and managing pharmaceutical waste. She is a registered pharmacist who received her B.S. in pharmacy and M.S. in continuing and vocational education from the University of Wisconsin. Ms. Smith is a member of the Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin, the American Society of Health System Pharmacists, and the American Society for Healthcare Environmental Services. She also serves on the NIOSH Hazardous Drug Working Group. Welcome, Ms. Smith.
Thank you so much, Becky, and I want to welcome everyone here today. We appreciate you taking time out to be with us. We've got a lot to go over, so let's jump right in. We're going to talk about what's happening on Capitol Hill to drive compliance. We're going to spend a little bit of time on defining a hazardous pharmaceutical waste. Some of you may be very familiar with this information, but others, it may be new to you, and we didn't want to not address that. We're also going to talk about universal waste and its impact, and then finally, how you can come into compliance relatively quickly. A lot's been happening in the last year. About a year ago, in March of 2008, you probably remember the Associated Press did a series of three articles on drugs in drinking water. That got a lot of press in most of the major outlets, and it really caused quite a bit of discussion all the way up to Washington. And then in September of last year, again the Associated Press did a three-part article on drug disposal from healthcare facilities. They spent some time in Minnesota, which has been very aggressive. They have probably 70% of their hospitals in compliance now with hazardous waste rules. And they took data from Minnesota and extrapolated that so that they calculated about 250 million pounds of drug waste being disposed from hospitals and other long-term care and other healthcare facilities nationally per year, with about half of that being packaging. So that still gives us about 125 million pounds of actual drug waste. So it's certainly not an insignificant number and has caught a lot of attention. It's no coincidence that following the March Associated Press article, there was a Senate hearing with Senators Boxer and Lautenberg, and Ben Grumbles, who was then Assistant Administrator for Water for EPA, was one of the speakers. Likewise, in September, following that Associated Press series of articles, was another hearing, this time in the House, and again had EPA in front of them, kind of questioning, you know, what's happening at EPA and why are we hearing it from the press first and that sort of thing. Well, that has stimulated some action, and in the first 3 months of 2009, it's really quite remarkable. We have had a drug waste-related act introduced into the House every month so far. The first one is the Drug-Free Water Act of 2009, introduced in January. That's a very broad act that would require EPA to convene a task force regarding the proper disposal of unused pharmaceuticals. The next two, the Safe Drug Disposal Act and the Secure and Responsible Drug Disposal Act, would require a change in the Controlled Substances Act, primarily to enable consumer take-back programs. Any of you who have tried to do consumer take-back know that one of the big stumbling blocks is the Drug Enforcement Administration requirement that you have to have a sheriff present, which makes it difficult to have an ongoing program. So these two acts, a little different in their composition, but were really designed to do that. We'll have to watch and see if we get any more action at that level. Now, regarding EPA itself, it's important to remember we have two separate parts of EPA that impact pharmaceutical waste. One is the Office of Water, and the second is the former Office of Solid Waste, which took a name change in January. They're now the Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery, and they regulate the hazardous waste side. On the water side, they've actually been working on this at least since 2006, and they've done some voluntary surveys to try to determine what drugs and how many drugs are going into the sewer system. Now they have permission from the Office of Management and Budget through a process last year with a 90-day question and answer comment period to put out a survey, which will probably be administered September through November is what we're hearing now, to between 3,000 and 3,500 facilities, which will include hospitals, long-term care facilities, hospices, and veterinary practices. This is a pretty hefty survey. I know one of our colleagues, Fred Masumi in Nebraska, has been working very hard with them to try to make it a reasonable survey, because initially EPA thought that hospitals were documenting all drugs that were being disposed down the drain, which, of course, is not the fact. So it would have been very difficult even to do a 30-day response on that. What's interesting about this survey, there's no penalty for your answers, but there is a criminal penalty for the CEO of the facility or whoever the owner might be if they don't return it and certify that it's been done as accurately as possible. So that will certainly get some attention from the CEOs, especially at some of these larger facilities. That, of course, can have impact down the road because the EPA Office of Water does regulate what the effluent is coming out of wastewater treatment plants. Probably a longer-term impact, but could certainly be very large. Now, flipping back over to the other side of the aisle with the Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery, who manage the hazardous waste side, they have a proposal that they had open for comment earlier this year, up until March 4th, where they're proposing to add pharmaceuticals to the Universal Waste Rule. And this is a very confusing topic. We're going to spend a little more time on it in a few minutes. But it's important to know that it only applies to drugs that already meet the definition of a RCRA hazardous waste, which is about 4% of the drugs in the market. Even though EPA is encouraging in this proposal to have healthcare facilities manage all drugs as universal waste, that would take it to the highest level of disposal at a hazardous waste facility and the most expensive. So it may not be likely that larger facilities would be willing to do that. The good news about it, though, it does streamline the management of these drugs. It does take them out of the calculation for your waste generator status. And those of you who have wrestled with trying to document your P-listed waste and the 2.2 pounds per calendar month, that would all go away, which would be a tremendous benefit. It's not going to happen overnight. They said at least 18 months from the close of the comment period for federal enactment, and then every state except Iowa or Alaska who don't have a state program for RCRA would have to adopt it. So we are looking at a long-term process here. I do want to spend a couple minutes for those of you who might be new to this topic, just telling you what we're talking about with some of these acronyms. RCRA is the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. It was enacted in 1976. As we mentioned, it's enforced by the Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. And it was really designed for heavy industry because of a lot of the problems we'd had with hazardous waste being buried and leaching and so forth. So one of the problems we have in healthcare, it was never really designed for us. And they weren't taking into account IV bags and vials and syringes and that when they set the rules up. EPA has been working hard over the last few years to come up with certain modifications to make it a little bit easier. The rule defines hazardous waste. It requires cradle-to-grave tracking right now with a six-part uniform manifest, and households are exempt. It's important to know that EPA did just take a cost-of-living raise, which they are required by law to do about every 4 years or so. So now the authority to fine civilly went from $32,500 up to $37,500 as of January 12th. And the whole point of increasing these fines periodically, they never want violating to become a cost of doing business. So they do have the opportunity to make it painful enough, obviously, that folks want to get into compliance. For those of you, again, who are new to this, it's a very serious rule. It has both civil and criminal liability. I've not heard of it going criminal in healthcare. I did hear of a professor in Washington State who knowingly, willfully dumped ignitable solvent into the sewer system and, to my knowledge, was fined and may have spent a little jail time, actually. So they certainly can do this if they feel it's necessary. Hopefully we won't have that happen in healthcare, and the best way to avoid that, of course, is for all of us to move into compliance as soon as we can. It is important for you to know that your managers up through the CEO are liable, however, so that you can get some assistance from your administrative folks. Looking at which discarded drugs become a RCRA hazardous waste, you may have heard about the P list, and these are drugs that are the sole active ingredient. If they're unused and sole active, they will become a hazardous waste. What's even more interesting, even the empty containers will remain a hazardous waste unless they're triple rinsed and the rinsate discarded is hazardous. That doesn't make sense in healthcare. So what we recommend is, except for a couple of exemptions I'll mention in a bit, that you do manage all of these as hazardous waste. If you add water to them, you simply create more. It's likewise with the U-listed chemicals. If it's the sole active ingredient and unused, it will become a hazardous waste when it's discarded. These are actually the easiest because you can go into the Code of Federal Regulations, you can look at the hundreds of chemicals listed, and you can pick the drugs out. What's much more difficult are the characteristics of hazardous waste: ignitability, toxicity, corrosivity, and reactivity, because these are formulation dependent. So it really depends on looking exactly at what you have in your particular product to see if it meets any one of these characteristics. Let's take a little deeper dive now and look at the P list and some of the changes that have occurred. These are all the drugs that we've been able to identify on this list. Arsenic trioxide, we recognize as a chemo drug, very toxic. That's why I have it in yellow, just to let it stand out a little bit. We're not surprised about that. The good news on epinephrine is that for those of you who've been involved in this for more than a year now, up until a year ago, October in 2007, all the epinephrine was considered to be a hazardous waste. Fortunately, at that time, EPA made a decision or determination that the rule did not say salts back in 1976, so the salts were excluded. All of the epinephrine we use in healthcare are salts. They're either borates, bitartrates, or hydrochlorides. So none of the epinephrine used in our finished dosage forms is regulated at the federal level. It's important that you check with your states. Many states have adopted this. Not all have. So it is important to note that, because epinephrine was really the P-listed waste that was kicking just about every hospital into large quantity generator status. All you need is one IV bag per month, and you were there. So this has been a huge shift and a big help for folks. Nicotine, of course, is listed, but here's another interesting one. If you put it on as a patch and you take it off, it's now used. So it falls out of regulation technically, but it still has a lot of the drug left, probably 85-90%. So we recommend you manage it as a hazardous waste as a best management practice, but you don't need to under the rule, unless you're in a state like Minnesota or Washington that has tougher rules. Nitroglycerin is interesting also. That's been P-listed because of reactivity, and certainly pure nitro is very reactive. Fortunately, all of our dosage forms are so weak, they've never exploded, which is a good thing for us and our patients, and as of 2001, EPA excluded weak nitroglycerin from the P-list, and many states have adopted that exclusion, but not all. So again, you need to check. Phentermine, the diet drug, controlled substance, you probably won't see much of that. Physostigmine and the salicylate you'll have in your ORs, that's something you do have to worry about. And then all the warfarin tablets meet the P list, so all of those would be considered hazardous. More importantly for warfarin, since you're not throwing out a lot of tablets, would be the empty containers. And unless you have approval from your state, you do need to manage the empty warfarin bottles and even your wrappers as hazardous waste. And I know that doesn't make sense. So one of the things we have to get used to with RCRA is there's still some areas that aren't logical and rational to us, but unfortunately we have to live with them for now. Let's take a look at some of the U-listed drugs. Chloral hydrate's a controlled substance. We recommend in pediatrics you go with a patient-specific oral syringe if possible. That will eliminate the wastage that you would get from a unit dose cup. The items in yellow are all chemo, and you'll notice they're very old chemo because these were the ones in use in 1976. You'll also notice we're missing about 100 other chemo drugs that aren't listed. And this is one of our other frustrations, that the law has not kept up. So, you know, we're managing warfarin bottles, but we're not managing 100 really tough chemo drugs. So we really want to encourage you to manage any unused chemo as hazardous waste. You'll see lindane on here, saccharin, selenium sulfide. All of these would be caught under the U list. If we move into Igniteability now, we have several definitions. One is an aqueous solution containing 24% alcohol or more by volume and a flash point of less than 140 degrees Fahrenheit. It's extremely difficult to find flash point data for drugs, so we really recommend if you've got an aqueous solution with the 24% alcohol, call it Igniteable and don't worry about the flash point. A good example here is paclitaxel that you see. That's 50% alcohol coming into pharmacy. Once you dilute it and send it up to the floor, it falls out of regulation as an ignitable. However, it would still be considered a chemo drug, and we'd recommend if you do have to throw it out at that level that you manage it as hazardous because of its toxicity. We have some non-aqueous solutions like flexible collodion, or, of course, the alcohols that would hit the flash point level. We also have a few oxidizers and some flammable aerosols. On all of these would be considered ignitable. They have only one waste code of D001. Corrosivity is really easy. It's either a pH of less than or equal to 2 or greater than or equal to 12.5, so very acidic or very basic. And normally you'd only find these in your compounding cupboard. Hopefully you don't have many of those left. Certainly your laboratory would have to take a look at this. These are really very far-reaching limits in the sense it's very acidic and very basic. We actually recommend if you have something right on the verge that you actually manage it as corrosive because it could still do a lot of damage. But hopefully you won't see much of this. These should not be put into, quote, the pharmaceutical waste. These should be lab-packed by your hazardous waste broker. Here's where you can have some real problems with reactions and so forth. So be sure that those are handled separately. By far the hardest characteristic is that of toxicity because there's 40 chemicals that EPA has listed that they do not want going into a landfill over a specific concentration of milligram per liter, and it's different for each one of these. And it's considered, it's called a toxicity characteristic leaching procedure, or TCLIP. It's actually an analytical test. So if you were going to be very pristine, you would take everything that you had that had any of these ingredients in it and send it out for this TCLIP, which would be pretty expensive. So what we've done at Pharmacology is a paper TCLIP where we've gone and looked at the molecular weights of the molecules, like with barium sulfate, for example, figured out what the actual concentration would be in the product if it was discarded and see whether it would pass or fail the TCLIP. Barium's a great example because when you actually run a TCLIP, it gets absorbed, so you get a little bit of a benefit from that. And we've now gotten some TCLIPs from some of the manufacturers, but it's a very subtle thing, and if you're not absolutely sure that you know whether it's going to pass or fail, we recommend that you do manage it as a hazardous waste. You'll see also cadmium, chromium, and selenium here. They're going to occur in your total parenteral nutrition. Certainly when you make the IV, they'll fall out, but when you bring it into pharmacy as a concentrate, some of those are going to fail. M-cresol is the preservative in human insulin, which can cause it to fail. And then mercury, of course, is present as a preservative in thimerosal or phenylmercuric acetate. We have still vaccines and some of our eye and ear preps that have thimerosal as a preservative, which will cause it to fail. And then silver we have in our burn creams, plus any of you in safety out there, you now have a lot of silver coming into the hospital for its antiseptic and anti-infective effect, like in catheters and so forth. It's being impregnated in there. You really need to talk to those manufacturers and find out whether that's going to fail a TCLIP when you throw it out. Just to kind of solidify this information, because toxicity is so subtle, you can see the silver sulfadiazine burn cream, your selenium and chromium, for TPN, or total parenteral nutrition. Multi-dose Fluvax, usually folks end up with that at the end of the season. It cannot go back. It's non-returnable when you buy it. So it is a waste at your facility, and that you'd have to manage as a hazardous waste. And then finally, the Humalog and the other insulins that you'd see. And then our final characteristic is reactivity. And nitroglycerin, fortunately, as I mentioned, has been excluded in finished dosage forms. You just have to be absolutely sure that your state has adopted that. But that's a terrific benefit because of the heavy glass bottles and ointments and so forth and all the different ways that nitro is packaged. I just want to reiterate again that we really encourage you to manage these extra 100 or so chemo drugs as hazardous waste. Those of you in pharmacy and nursing recognize them as very toxic chemo drugs. We really don't want them going anywhere but to the highest level of destruction. And that leads me to talk a little bit about what we're now saying, three types of chemo waste. Many of you are familiar with the yellow containers that you've been using for the last 20 years. And for many years, we would put all the chemo in there because it made sense. It said chemotherapy waste. And what many of us in pharmacy, when we were doing IV prep, didn't realize is these yellow containers are going to a medical waste hauler and being incinerated at a regulated medical waste incinerator, which is great for, quote, trace chemo. But if you put a half a vial of Cytox in there, which is you listed, you're actually violating federal law. So what we want to do is have only empty vials, syringes, and IVs, or your normally used gowns, gloves, Ziploc bags, and so forth, anything that could be trace contaminated going into that yellow trace chemo container for appropriate incineration as an infectious medical waste. That includes your sharps can go in there at a regulated medical waste incinerator. We really want to encourage you, what we're calling bulk chemo, which is a highly technical term that we kind of came up with in the industry to differentiate this. If it's not empty, then the container, if it's chemo, should go into these black RCRA hazardous waste containers. There's nothing sacred about black, by the way, or yellow for that matter, but this is kind of what the industry standard has become. It's also important to know if you have to do spill cleanup on any RCRA waste, including chemo, that should go into the black container. And people say, well, what about the gowns? If your gowns and gloves are not overtly contaminated, I think that's legitimate to put into trace. If you can see that you've gotten chemo spilled on it in any way, that should go into the black. And I want to just mention, we really encourage you to have your farm techs or who's ever receiving chemo, get them gloved immediately before they open up anything, because they have now documented contamination from the manufacturer on the vials and therefore even on the cardboard packaging that the vials are contained in. So from an OSHA perspective, you want to be careful. Now, we talked about empty versus non-empty, and that's really a technical term in RCRA. So as I mentioned, for the P-listed drugs, unless you triple rinse the container and the rinsate's discarded as hazardous, which makes no sense in healthcare, you do have to manage that container as a hazardous waste. We also then have a different definition for the U-listed drugs and what we're calling the D-codes, which is your ignitables, your corrosives, and so forth. Those containers are not considered empty unless you've done two things. You've removed all the contents that can be removed through normal means, and there's no more than 3% by weight remaining. In pharmacy, we kind of lost track of the first part of the definition, and we said, oh, as long as we've only got 3%, we're good, or we even moved that over to 3 mils. It got morphed into 3 mils, but that's not accurate. If you can see drug in there that you could pull out with a needle and a syringe, or if you've got an IV bag where you could still drain contents out of it, that's not empty. So the easy thing to tell nursing, don't worry about the 3%. Just tell them if there's drug in it, it's not empty. If there's no drug in it, it is empty. That's really the simplest way to do that. Now, we have one exclusion, which actually has gotten expanded, which is great. We had an exclusion from 1994 for epinephrine syringes that were used. Well, epi's out of our concern now, but fortunately, as of last April, they expanded that to include other and PNU-listed drugs. EPA expanded it. So if you're transferring arsenic trioxide with a needle and syringe down in the prep area, you can dispose of that in the trace chemo. You don't have to create that expensive dual waste of biohaz and RCRA. Now, if you have, say, up in surgery, you've got physostigmine loaded in a syringe with a needle, and you don't use it, you still have then the double dual biohaz and RCRA, and it has to be double labeled, and you have to make sure your vendor can take that. So just some things that are pretty subtle here to keep in mind. Many of you have now seen the newer containers. Black has become kind of a traditional color, if you call it tradition, to differentiate these. There are also needle boxes available if you wanted to have that dual waste or if you want to keep it in a patient room for any reason, and you obviously can't allow access. So it kind of shows you the difference between what we were used to with the old trace chemo and now the newer containers. Now I'd like to move into talking about universal waste. There's two states that have already pioneered this, Michigan and Florida. There's been a few unintended consequences. I think Florida has kind of gotten the brunt of this the most. They've had a lot more enforcement there. One of the problems is that when you deal with universal waste, you're allowing folks who normally wouldn't be handling drugs to take custody of Legend Drugs. So now you have unregistered entities having this custody. And that was kind of a surprise to the Department of Health in Florida when they found out. They have the state board embedded in them. They got involved. So it's important that state boards of pharmacy and the DEA be involved in this process. Just to help us visualize this a little better, the large chartreuse circle, if we consider that to be federal RCRA hazardous waste, which includes some pharmaceuticals, then we have universal waste as a subset of the federal rules. Right now, in the current universal waste rule, we have batteries, pesticides, mercury-containing devices like thermometers and thermostats, and lamps or bulbs that have mercury in them. And the place where universal came from is that all of these items occur universally throughout our culture, whether it's in your home, in a store, in an industrial use, they occur all over. And the point of universal waste originally from the 1990s was to make it easier for collection and or recycling of these items, to bring them in from the mass culture and not penalize, say, a Sears Automotive if they're taking your battery back, that they can dispose of it properly. So this new idea then is to add pharmaceuticals to this particular subset, which, as I mentioned, Florida has done. Well, that brings up some interesting possibilities. The goal of universal waste in general is to encourage resource conservation, improve implementation of the current regs, and separate the universal waste from the municipal waste stream so that people don't discard it in the trash or, for that matter, put these down the drain. Some of the reasons for proposing this that EPA has given us, it will, and this is one of the big ones, it'll enable the waste generator to avoid becoming a large quantity generator due to the generation of P-listed waste. That's where that 1 kilogram or 2.2 pounds per calendar month was really becoming problematic. Even though we got rid of nitro and epi, you still have to document, and that is a lot of work. So by getting rid of that, that's a terrific benefit. It enables continued reverse distribution of outdated drugs that become hazardous waste but may be creditable. And, you know, I come from the reverse distribution industry with capital returns many years ago, and we worked off of those two letters where EPA said you could reverse distribute an outdated product. Well, they really thought that some of these were being recycled or reused, and once they found out that doesn't happen, it kind of put them between a rock and a hard place because you're not supposed to reverse distribute a hazardous waste if it can never be reused. So this would eliminate their concern about that. It also could enable easier household collection in those states, like Wisconsin, where when you bring drugs back into a central location from a household, it now kicks the rules in again. And we have some waivers here in the state for now. But I mentioned households are exempt. Some states, as I mentioned, are stricter once they come back in, so this would help them. And then it would remove any concerns about using reverse distributors as a national take-back model on a mail-back process, which has occurred here in Wisconsin. We had a pilot with Capital, which was really pretty cool, where two counties, folks could call an 800 number and send their drugs in. So there's a lot happening on that side of the fence. If we look at some of the expectations that EPA has, they expect that there will be improved management of hazardous pharmaceutical waste. They expect that the regulatory burden will decrease for many pharmaceutical waste generators, and they hope that this proposal will provide a solution to many of the other issues facing healthcare facilities. One of my concerns, and we expressed this on the docket in 18 pages, is that they still need to look at things like, what about the warfarin bottles? That doesn't get fixed by this. What about the fact we don't have those chemo drugs listed? That wouldn't necessarily be fixed by this. So it's not really a panacea unless they also make some other changes. Now, I mentioned earlier that this only impacts about 4% of the drugs in the market. It really does not legally address the other 96% of the drugs. They are hoping at EPA that this will bring attention to the industry regarding the proper disposal of pharmaceutical waste. They're hoping you will manage to that highest level, but that's a very expensive proposition. If you take a look at what we typically see in hospitals, and these are averages from 149 hospitals that we performed an inventory analysis for in 2008, 4% of the drugs were RCRA, just as we found in the database originally. About 10% are a category we call Farm E hazardous, which gets those collects those chemo drugs along with some other drugs that probably should be looked at, and then 86% were non-hazardous. So again, that little red sector is the only one that the rule actually applies to. Now, the next couple of slides, I do just want to raise some issues that we've had concerns about and did comment on. These are pharmacology's concerns, and I just want to take responsibility for those. One of the problems that I think we have in coming out of pharmacy, we're real sensitive to this, is that the street value of even a non-controlled substance, you know, not DEA, drug of abuse, does continue to climb due to increased drug costs and shrinking personal resources. So we're very concerned about opening up the back end of the supply chain, if you will, to what I like to say, two men in a truck showing up and saying, we can take your universal farm waste without having any real documentation other than a simple manifest, because you do lose the six-part manifest under universal waste rules the way they are set up now. You would never get back at your hospital documentation that actually got to the right facility, which would be a RCRA hazardous waste facility. Even empty containers of very expensive drugs have been known to be diverted and refilled with something else, whether it's water or saline or whatever it is, and then introduced back into the supply chain. Those of you who don't work with this all day long may not realize there's a tremendous amount of effort going into ensuring the forward supply chain. There's problems with both counterfeiting and diversion. The FDA is heavily involved, along with, of course, DEA and your state regulatory authorities, to try to make sure that everyone who's handling drugs, from the manufacturers through the distributors, the reverse distributors, and obviously healthcare facilities, have licenses, inspections, background checks, physical securities, even pedigrees to tell you where that drug came from. They're actually now looking even at possibly serializing very high-value drugs, so every dosage form, like a vial, would have its own number on it. So a lot of work going into that forward supply chain. We just don't want to destroy that. Another issue we're concerned about is OSHA. Well, when you have folks involved with bulbs and batteries currently who are currently universal waste handlers, they see this as a great business opportunity. What they don't realize, not having been in our business, is that if they take, and I have one instance where this has happened, they would take all the chemo waste in one container, take it to their warehouse, and then spread it out and sort it. And for those of you, especially in pharmacy or oncology nursing, you know that without personal protective equipment and without engineering controls, you are exposing workers. And I think it's a matter of a naive group who haven't had this experience that we went through for the last 40 years to recall that we did have some real problems with this. So I think those are concerns that need to be addressed. One of the questions we get asked a lot is, well, I'm just going to wait, or should I wait, until the universal waste rule to develop my system? And the answer really is a resounding no. First of all, we're talking years, probably at least a year and a half federally, additional years for states to adopt it, and you're at risk right now. By moving into it now, you will work yourself through the process so that if and when this does become a rule, it will give you some relief from what you're doing. But right now, you could be audited, you could be fined, and you can't tell them, well, I'm waiting for the universal waste rule, because RCRA has been in place since 76. A lot of the regulators feel they've given healthcare ample time, 30 years, to get on board. So you really don't want to use this. It'll simply make it easier for you if it does go through. What I'd like to do now is look at how you might begin, because we're trying to make these seminars more and more practical as more and more people do get up to speed in more organizations. So your first job is to identify which drugs become a hazardous waste, determine which implementation model you're going to use, and we'll show you some examples in a moment. It's important to always pilot your labeling and segregation process in the pharmacy, and we recommend the oncology units, not only because that's a relatively small area to work with, but also that's probably your highest risk of inspection. Someone walks in and does not see hazardous waste in those two areas, they know that you have a problem. Then you'd want to move towards developing and implementing your full house rollout, and we'd also like to introduce our PharmaCertification to you today, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. Probably the simplest way to find out which drugs are hazardous waste, we'd love to work with you and perform an inventory analysis. You'd simply send us from the pharmacy a 12-month purchase history from your drug wholesaler. You can run that yourself or they can run it for you. Add any direct purchases. We use very standard data fields that everybody has available to them, your NDC brand name, generic name, and so forth. And that would come into us on an Excel spreadsheet. In addition to giving you the codes for the P's, U's, and D's, we would also identify for you those drugs that are considered PharmE hazardous. And we've included any drug on the NIOSH Hazardous Drug Alert Appendix A, anything that's considered a carcinogen, drugs with very low LD50s, making them highly toxic, endocrine disruptors, and a few other categories. But drugs which, if they were looked at today, might actually move into hazardous waste. Some of the benefits of using this system, we can provide a very quick turnaround for you. 10 working days is the max. So let's say someone does inspect you and they give you a 60-day notice of violation. Within 2 weeks, you can have a drug list back and show them that you have made significant progress. I have had folks try to do this themselves. After 6 months to a year, they finally throw up their hands. You don't have time in pharmacy, and it's really a pharmacy job. You really don't have time taking care of patients to spend your time on this. The other thing we're real pleased about is that we're now providing specific container recommendations, and I'll show you an example of that in a moment. And we have carved out and extracted an OSHA hazardous drug list that we can present to you along with your inventory analysis. So you can use that to get up to speed, make sure you're up to speed on the hazard communication standard. And very soon, within the next month, we're going to be providing DOT shipping names, and I'm going to show you a little bit what that's going to look like. Once you have your drugs initially inventoried and categorized, you do need a system to maintain the system, and we would like to offer you the PharmE Waste Wizard. This is our patented online database. You can look up any drug in the marketplace. We update it every week from data from Medispan, one of the big national data providers, and we have two pharmacists that do the waste categorization. We're extremely pharmacist-oriented. Both our, as I mentioned, our people that do waste and also our people that do on-site risk assessments are registered pharmacists with a lot of experience, and we found out it just makes it easier because they can understand your systems a lot better. One of the things we're enhancing again here are the container recommendations. So we're going to be telling you for a particular item where to put it if it's full and partial versus empty, and if it's a syringe versus, say, a vial or an IV. And this is a lot of brain damage because we got about 160,000 items and we had to really sort through this. We're using the Covidian color scheme, that's the Kendall company, because they have been have the broadest market selection. So you're certainly free to use any container you want, but we wanted something specific that we could refer you to. We're also very pleased that sometime during second quarter, which we've now entered, we will be introducing our MSDS online program. They're working with us right now creating what's called an e-binder, which will allow you to go right from either a RCRA hazardous drug or an OSHA hazardous drug to the MSDS for that particular drug. And those of you who have used MSDS online know, you know, they have about 3 million MSDSs. But if the OSHA inspector is over your shoulder or there's been a spill, it's sometimes a little difficult to get right to that product. This would allow you to get there literally within seconds. So we're looking forward to that. This shows you what your search screen results would be. In this case, we're telling you it's nicotine and the P number is 75. It's toxic. We're telling you if it's full or partially used, it's a black hazardous. Empty packaging, it's also, unfortunately, a black hazardous because it's P-listed, unless you have specific guidance from your state not to do that. But this kind of gives you an idea of the level of detail. In this particular case, in our next one, we have a chemo drug. It's PharmE hazardous, so it's recommended to go into toxic and black hazardous. But this case, if it's an empty package, it can go into yellow trace. You can see that on the bottom line there. And then we also indicate that it is chemotherapy and a potential hazardous product. We have more information behind that, but I think this gives you just a quick review of that. So now you know which drugs you need to sort or at least have segregated at some point. Now you have to look at how you're going to communicate that. And we recommend that in pharmacy you shelf sticker. I know we've got a lot of shelf stickers already. This is one more, but that's probably the most efficient way to do it. We don't recommend that you label everything coming into stock. That's not needed and it's not always relevant. So you can certainly use shelf stickers in pharmacy. nursing is really the much tougher obstacle, and we're going to recommend, if possible, you put data into your dispensing software or into Pyxis or into your medication administration record, whatever electronic way you have of doing it, because you only need to load that once, and you don't need to be doing it each time you dispense. If you have some type of label systems, and I know many of you have four or five or more different ways you label drugs, you may have to apply stickers manually. So you really have to look at doing a label map to determine how you need to move forward. In the Practice Green Health Blueprint, which used to be Hospitals for Healthy Environment, if you haven't read that yet, we've identified five different models, and there is an August 2008 version. I recommend make sure you get the one off the HERC site, H-E-R-C. That will give you the updated version. You can use an automated waste sorting system. We recommend otherwise that you put the data in your software, manually custom label it, or you can, in many states, do a central sort model where you put it all in one container, take it to the storage area, and have the vendor segregate it. If you're a very small organization, like maybe a critical access hospital, you may want to look at Model 5. Managing it all is hazardous. It may not be worth it to do the segregating. If you're a large facility, we've worked with one facility over 600 beds, it would have cost them $1 million to do that. So there is a tipping point where it's more cost-effective to segregate than it is to manage it all as hazardous. Once you've done your pilots and determined which method you're going to use, you need to develop your policies and procedures that can be applicable to the entire facility. It's extremely important that you involve all your stakeholders, especially nursing, because they will make or break the system for you. They're going to be throwing out most of the drugs, and you absolutely have to have them involved. We highly recommend you use a flowchart system, pictorial diagrams, anything you can do visually to make it easier for pharmacy and nursing to do the segregation. And then you have to be sure to update your spill management plans, because in addition to chemo, you could have a non-chemo hazardous waste spill, like lindane, for example, that you would need to take care of, or physostigmine. So you have to be sure that you have that in place also. One of the things we've developed over the last couple of years are a set of policies and procedures for each one of those blueprint implementation models, and we've embedded that in what we call 7 steps to compliance, because one of the challenges you have when you get at the table with your colleagues is where do you begin? So we like to recommend that people actually use the steps in their internal meetings and their task forces to work themselves through the process. And we've put in some diagnostic aids, you know, which model should you use, what is your generator status, those types of questions and answers. And then in step 4, we actually have Word templates for each one of the models, and there's between 20 and 22 policies and procedures. And each one of those, this was really hard. It took a couple of years because we tried to think through everything. And even if you choose to consolidate those, it will walk you through the process so you won't miss any steps. This is what one of our clients have done, which I think is real creative. They took standard off-the-shelf Avery shipping labels. You can get them at Office Max. They created a black background, a matrix, using the Avery system, put P's, U's, and D's, one on each sheet, and then pressed those out and simply did a walkthrough, probably took about a half a day, and got their entire pharmacy shelves labeled. And you can see they're very dramatic. They show up. Certainly if an inspector were to come in, they would be very impressed that they not only know that they're hazardous, but what the basic code is. Another one of our facilities that we've worked with, the Leahy Clinic, has done the IV label, and they use the term HD drug because they're collecting a little bit more. They want to get the rest of the chemo drugs in there and some other drugs. But you can see they've circled it for our view here. They've also indicated the P listed and the U listed. Lindane's got the U list. Now, they still have to manage nitro because Massachusetts hasn't gotten around to it yet. We're hoping this is the month. But they still have to manage nitro as P-listed. So this is a really nice way to do it because you don't have to be doing something each time you send an IV up. It's automatically on there. Leahy and a number of other facilities have also put messages into their Pyxis or other automated dispensing devices so that these will pop up and alert nursing when they have to dispose of those properly. And very often they'll set it up so that nursing has to key past it or that they can't just ignore it. They have to actually actively key past it so that they're sure to catch it. So that's a very nice way to do it. Some of our other facilities have decided to go with manual labeling. This is North Memorial up in Minneapolis. They've got their special disposal required, and they sort right up at the units so that the nurses know if this label's on there, it goes into the black container. It makes it very obvious for them. UW Health in Madison, Wisconsin, has done a kind of a hybrid system where they will label all their liquids as hazardous if needed, but all the non-liquids and solids do go as hazardous waste. So they've taken a little different approach. So you can see a lot of different ways that you can work through this. Once you've actually started training, this is a good example, again, of the Lahey Clinic Medical Center. This is one of their training slides, taking an example, in this case insulin. So if it's a used syringe, it goes into red sharps. An empty vial goes into the trash. A half-empty vial goes into black, and an outdated goes back to pharmacy. So very clear as to what nursing should do with these, depending on what they have remaining. This is another example from Lahey, again, for their training program, describing what they're calling their soft hamper. This is a great way to save money, to use the soft chemo bags for your gowns and gloves and chucks and so forth, and save the sharps for the actual needles or glass or those types of items, so you don't have to be using up quite as many of the sharps containers. And then, of course, on the right-hand side, all the bulk chemo or the chemo spill products. So again, a nice example of what folks have done. This just gives you a snapshot of some folks in their satellite accumulation areas. You'll see in the middle they have a waste chart posted right by the satellite accumulation. Down on the right hand, they've got it specifically labeled as satellite accumulation. These are foot pedal operated in many cases, which we recommend because they'll keep them from tipping and they can be hands-free because we had them open to take the shots, but they are supposed to be closed when they're in active use. This is an example of storage accumulation. You can see in the lower right side that particular facility will ship that out every week. So a lot of hazardous waste being generated. And then a little bit, not clear, but there is labeling specific on that one on the left side. The yellow label is a typical hazardous waste label. It has both DOT and EPA information in it. One of the things that we strongly recommend is that you work with your hazardous waste vendor to create a certified hazardous waste profile of all the toxic and ignitable drug codes, including, if possible, ignitable aerosols. We've worked a lot with Veolia, for example, who is a national hazardous waste vendor, and we have now, between us, determined that it's very appropriate to use a shipping name, which I've given you here. It's Waste Medicine Liquid Flammable Toxic. It's very fortunate that it was just in January of this year that the DOT removed an 11-pound limit on this shipping name, allowing hospitals and the vendors to use this because it's a highly descriptive name for the particular waste we're generating. We do recommend, obviously, that you segregate any corrosive acids and bases or any oxidizers. What we've done in this next pie chart is taken the hazardous drugs in that were provided to us through these 149 hospitals, and we split them out where we've got 66% toxic, that lower big slice, 25% ignitable, 6% ignitable aerosol, and you can see very small oxidizers and bases. We're finding in most cases 97% of the drugs can be commingled, and that makes it so much easier whether you're sorting on the floor or however you decide to sort. It makes it much easier than having multiple waste streams. So hopefully that will be helpful to you. We don't want to forget that big 86% or 85%, even though they're called non-hazardous under RCRA. We know now we've got antibiotics in there, antidepressants, other drugs that are causing problems in the environment. We really want to encourage you to go all the way to managing these through either regulated medical waste incineration or waste-to-energy municipal incineration, rather than putting them in the landfill or down the drain. And again, you can see here North Memorial has done that. They have both those available so that nursing will put them in one or the other. And here again, you can see accumulation of these types, very similar, only they are stored in a separate location. These can be stored with your biohazardous red containers because they are considered biohazardous unless for some reason you're absolutely sure you're not going to put needles in there. So you can do that either way. And then finally, I just want to mention to you, we're very pleased that we now have clients who have come through our certification process. We've offered this the last couple of years. It takes a while for people to get here because they have to get through their whole process and implement their policies and procedures. And what we do is verify that, if followed, those policies and procedures will allow them to be in compliance. We're very happy to work with these facilities to send out press releases if they so desire. We also notify their EPA region and their respective state environmental protection agency that they've accomplished this. And if you are a Practice Green Health member, they will also make an announcement to give you as much good PR from this as you possibly can have. We do provide a certificate, literally framed, so you have some tangible evidence that you've accomplished this. And we've had now several of our folks come through that. We look forward to having more get through that process. So in summary, I think we can expect increased attention. I think with the universal waste rule, EPA is going to use that for leverage to make sure that folks do get into compliance. We really encourage you not to wait for rule changes because you are at risk now. We want you to think of this in terms also of protecting not only your organization but your community. And then we also want you to avoid a crisis mode because that's really not comfortable for anyone in the organization. So I've given you some resources that you can take a look at your leisure. And why don't we now open the line for questions?
If you'd like to ask a question, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. If you need to withdraw your question, press the pound key. We'll pause just a moment to compile the question and answer session.
While we're waiting for questions to come through, as a reminder, the PowerPoint from today that you're seeing and the audio portion are being recorded and will be sent to you, the links to download those within the next few days.
Your first question comes from Kathy Jacobs. Your line is open. Kathy, if you're on mute, please unmute, and if you're on speakerphone, please get the handset. Your next question comes from Ralph North. Your line is open.
Hi, Ralph North. I'm with the University of Wisconsin System, and thank you for the presentation. It's excellent. I have a question about chloral hydrate, which is very commonly used for fixing mushrooms and fungi. And somehow our researchers are getting a hold of it. I commented on the recent EPA asking for non-registrant comments, but my specific question is that the U-listed waste U034 is chloral, which has a CAS number of 75-87-6. Chloral hydrate has a CAS number of 302-17-0, and I would maintain that they are not the same thing and that chloral hydrate is not a U-listed waste. Could you speak
to that,
please?
Well, that's a very logical conclusion, Ralph, but unfortunately, the state of Florida had the same thought, and they wrote to EPA several years ago and presented that argument, and EPA wrote back and said, well, that's true, they're different CAS numbers, but all the tests were actually done on chloral hydrate, and we consider chloral hydrate to be the U-listed waste. If you want to email me, I can send you that reference.
Okay.
It's in the public database.
Thank you.
Yep.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from the Baptist Health South Florida. Your line is open.
Yes. The question I have was, you said we could store the RCRA hazardous waste and biomedical waste in the same area?
No, I didn't say that.
Okay.
I said you could store non-hazardous farm waste with your biohaz. Your RCRA hazardous has to be in a separate storage accumulation area.
Okay.
Yeah.
But non-hazardous and hazardous can be together?
Non-hazardous and biohazardous, your red containers. You can have your yellow trace chemo, your white and blue non-haz, and your red stored together.
Okay, because right now our central accumulation area has a, basically we have they're not commingled, but we have our 55-gallon drums for both non-haz and hazardous together.
You should not have your non-hazardous stored with your hazardous.
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from Keith Preston. Your line is open.
Actually, it's Carolyn.
Hi, I was wondering if you can help us. We're just trying to sort through how to segregate chemo waste, specifically RCRA hazardous waste versus DOT classified hazardous waste.
Well, DOT doesn't classify hazardous waste. They classify
hazardous materials, yeah.
And they're concerned about ignitability. So what I mentioned with the commingling, the DOT is comfortable with toxics and ignitables being commingled because they do not react. So there is not a problem putting together, for example, you listed Cytoxan with, there's only three chemo drugs that are ignitable before you dilute them, like Taxol I mentioned. So those can be put together. You don't need to sort them for DOT. But you do need to label them as both flammable, liquid, and toxic. If you want to send me an email, I can maybe talk that over with you more.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Your next question comes from Ann. Your line is open.
Yes, it's a snapper, actually. And we used to take our chemo out as regulated medical waste because of trace and because the chemo was used up by the patient in any event. We take it all out by hazardous medical waste now.
When you say hazardous medical waste, do you mean RCRA?
Yes.
What are you doing with your sharps, your needles?
They're being taken out by a company that also handles them as hazardous waste.
Oh, do you have it double labeled with a biohaz label on it?
The chemo?
Yeah.
Yes.
So what you're saying is they're taking it out as a dual biohazardous and RCRA hazardous waste.
Right, that's correct.
Yeah, that's certainly legal. It still has to go to the highest level incinerator. They can't take it to a regulated medical waste incinerator. It has to go to a RCRA incinerator.
Right.
Okay. And in my experience, it's costing more to do that, but
yes.
maybe they didn't charge you more.
Yes. Now, what I'm saying is then I don't really need to get involved with, you know, the P and the U because I'm taking it out at the highest.
As long as you're not generating more than 2.2 pounds a month on that
right.
P list, and arsenic
okay.
trioxide would be your P listed drug.
Terrific. And the other thing was that, in terms of, it was my understanding that it didn't really matter the color container you used.
No, it doesn't matter.
Right, because I continue to use the yellow container, even though I take it out as the RCRA hazardous.
Well, you want to make sure that that's packing group 2. If you're shipping it that way. I know the black ones are packing group 2. That's
uh-huh.
a DOT requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to make sure that it's the right packing group.
Okay, very good.
Because it may not be.
Very good. I will
mm-hmm.
double check that.
Okay.
Packing group 2. Thank you.
Yeah.
Your next question comes from Santiago Chambers. Your line is open.
Hello, yes. What I need is the meeting number that goes inside of to join to see the PowerPoint presentation. I've been unable to access that from the information that was provided to me. And I call support services. By the way, the presentation was outstanding. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
I've got to take that one on. As far as the presentation, the meeting number again went out to all registrants last night. There was a confusion on it in the confirmation, and I apologize for that. The presentation, as stated, as long as you registered for this meeting, you
and
will
I did,
be receiving
yes.
links to that PowerPoint and the audio portion so you can view them together.
Well, I don't have those, and I did register prior and have the original email, but it just all I have is session password waste and a hyperlink.
What I'm saying is when we send you those links, you'll be able to link right in. It's going to come to you in a separate email, and it's just going to be email links that you click on, and it'll give you the audio on one link. And on the other one, it'll give you a PowerPoint just to download straight from a site. You won't have to go into any meeting room for it.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Keith Preston. Your line is open.
Hi, a related question. There's been a lot of concern about wasting of fentanyl patches after removed by patients. And I know this isn't directly applicable, but could you speak to that with any expertise as where to destroy or what waste stream they should go in?
Yeah, this is an ongoing controversy. The best we've been able to figure out right now is to fold them up and put them into a needle box configuration of the white container with the blue top and send it out for incineration as non-hazardous drug waste, because the needle box keeps people from going into it. It's locked on the wall. You still want to make sure when those get moved through the organization that they're documented and, you know, have a very careful movement of that. Keep them in the med room, for example, until they're taken off the wall. You know, is DEA happy about that? Probably not. But they cause problems in the sewer system. They block it up, and we don't really want the drugs down there. So it's a compromise, and but it seems to be the most reasonable compromise right now.
It's a white block, the white box, blue top, and they go out as hazardous waste for incineration.
No, they're not hazardous. They're non-hazardous. But they get incinerated either at a probably at a regulated medical waste incinerator would make the most sense.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from Jody Gillis. Your line is open.
Hi, my name is Michelle. We're a small critical access hospital. We're just kind of starting up on this, so it's really, really new to us. I work actually in the lab, and we're kind of wondering, where should we start in the lab? Do we have a lot of waste in the lab that we need to dispose of?
Yeah, you probably do. If you want to send me an email, the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program in Minnesota has done an excellent job for laboratories with Catherine Zimmer up there, and I can send you some information that will give you a list of laboratory chemicals.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Your next question comes from Amy Tran. Your line is open.
Oh, hi. Sorry, I have difficulty in getting in and still have a visual presentation and couldn't get in. So my question is that I missed the warfarin bottle. How can you repeat that for me, please?
Sure. Unfortunately, because warfarin is P-listed, the rules say that the container that held it is a hazardous waste unless you triple rinse it, which we won't be doing. Mm-hmm. So unless your state has agreed not to consider that hazardous waste, you have to manage the empty warfarin bottle as a hazardous waste.
So do I have to contact the state for that?
Well, if you don't want to do that, yeah, you'd have to. Otherwise, you just do it.
So if I don't rinse that, how do I just dispose it?
Hazardous waste.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. We tried Wisconsin. We contacted them, and they are holding firm. They're requiring those containers to be managed as hazardous waste.
Do you know by any chance California is considered hazardous waste?
We were just out there, and they have not. What they want to do, they want the California Hospital Association to petition them.
I see.
So you can maybe get your folks together out there and write a formal letter to them, or even get the Pharmacy Society to do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Your next question comes from Grace Medman. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you. I had a couple of questions, actually. There was a point in your presentation where you spoke about arsenic being drawn up and disposed of as trace chemo. I was just wondering if you could repeat the conditions around that.
Yeah. So let me do that one first.
Sure.
Before we had the expansion of the epinephrine syringe exclusion a year ago, when you drew that up and put it into the IV, you would have had to manage that syringe as a dual biohaz and hazardous waste because it wasn't triple rinsed. Now with the exclusion, as long as your state's okay with that, you can put that empty used syringe into the trace chemo. You don't have to put it into a dual hazardous biohazardous container. So that's a really good thing. Does that make sense?
Not really.
Okay.
I guess the dual biohazardous versus
it's P-listed.
Right.
So under the rules, it would normally be considered a hazardous waste even when it's empty,
mm-hmm.
because you're not going to triple rinse it. Now we have an exclusion for that.
Okay.
So you can put it in the yellow container because of that exclusion. And I should mention, on our website at primeecology.com, if you go to the news icon and scroll backwards through time, you will find that exclusion from a year ago that you can document in case you have a regulator that isn't aware of it.
But that's for so I guess if I give an example, let's say I have half of an ampule of arsenic that's been used and I drop the rest of it into a syringe, the amp goes into the trace?
No, the ampule is hazardous. It does not apply to ampules or vials.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, with that syringe, you have to use it. If you just draw it up mm-hmm. and you never use it, it's still hazardous.
Right, but the used syringe could go into the trace.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then my second question is in regards to the toxicity characteristic and a lot of our vaccines. I work at a pediatric institution, so we have a number of vaccines that have the thimerosal content in it, but if the dose is drawn up from the vial and perhaps there's always some overfill, is that overfill, you know, intended to be disposed of through the hazardous waste stream as well?
Well, you know, the definition, you've removed everything you can remove. If you could have drawn that up, it's not empty.
Okay. Okay.
Good point. Yeah, so it's still hazardous then.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Your next question comes from Nancy Snyder. Your line is open.
Hello, Charlotte. This is Nancy at University of Louisville. And we've been working on our hazardous waste plan for several months, and you've been helping us with that. One of the things recently that we've been looking at is in regard to the best practices to burn all the non-hazardous waste. And what we're seeing is the cost of that is really high because those plastic white containers mm-hmm. are so expensive, something like $17 to $34 depending on which vendor. What is your recommendation? I mean, is there another method where you could put these in some kind of a thick mill bag, and what would they need to go into to get sent and then burnt as opposed to sealing each one of those, you know, 15
yeah.
or 17-gallon containers, which we're doing 3 or 4 a day,
sure.
and burning that?
Yeah, that's a hard situation. You know, some people have taken it down and dumped them into larger barrels and that sort of thing, but not all of those can go in the incinerators. The problem with the bags, you know, you're going to have glass in there. You might even have needles in there. And then you are talking sharp. So I don't think we have a good answer for a good solution for that at this point, other than to be able to use them up as much as possible. Don't pull them unless they're filled, you know, or three-quarters full, whatever your decision is.
Right.
But it is a hard situation. And, you know, maybe at some point we'll get somebody really creative who will have a little different solution for that still protects people with the puncture proof and all that sort of thing. But we really don't recommend a lot of, you know, bagging because you could have risks with that
right.
internally.
Yeah, we're hoping somebody's going to, you know, because some of the vendors we've talked to have talked about creating a special burn box, which would be much cheaper.
Yeah.
But we
yeah.
haven't seen these products. We keep hearing them talk
sure.
about it. So I was wondering also if you had heard of anybody who had gone that step and actually created it.
No, I haven't. But, you know, that's a great opportunity for Premier.
Yes, it is.
To work with the vendors.
Well,
the
thank you. Keep passing that along because it's really very expensive to be burning these big plastic white
right.
containers.
Right.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from Anne's line. Your line is open.
One second before we start this. It's been a wonderful presentation, and I appreciate Charlotte taking the extra time beyond what we were scheduled for.
Thank you.
To make this the last question and ask that anyone else who has questions following this, reach out to Charlotte directly. If Charlotte, that's okay with you?
That's fine with me.
Thank you.
Okay, the last question was getting back to the warfarin. In a unit dose situation, unit blister packing, is that does the nurse have to concern herself with where she discards the blister pack of the warfarin?
Yes, she does, unless your state's agreed that they're going to not consider that hazardous.
Do you know about New York?
I don't know about New York.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I'll
but,
check
you know,
it.
I would recommend you folks get together again and petition the state.
Okay, thank you very
yeah.
much.
I'd like to thank everyone for joining today's call, especially Charlotte. You are a wonderful presenter. We really
thank
appreciate
you.
It. Again, we will be sending out emails to all of you with direct link in to have the audio recorded portion and this PowerPoint available for your review.
Thank you for your time today, and it's been a great hosting you.
This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.